Hi there, it's Matt here, and welcome back to the podcast. And this is a very different kind of podcast. It is a podcast that you have been asking for a long time. And that podcast is an AMA, an Ask Me Anything podcast. So I put a call out on social media and I received, oh my goodness, so many fantastic questions, half of which I've never thought about before. And I was so upset that I'd never thought about them before. And that's because I am so egotistical, clearly. So then what we did was we gathered together all of the questions and we tried to extract the most frequently asked themes or questions. And then we blended them into a singular question or a singular set of questions. So we have got so many to get through, more than we will be able to get through in this episode. This episode is probably, I've got no idea how long it's going to be. You will know because you can now look down and see the length of this podcast, but right now I've got no idea. And we're going to try and get through as many of those questions in a reasonable amount of time. So I am joined today by a fantastic partner in crime who is going to be not only asking the questions, but also adding some fantastic insights. My partner in crime today is my wonderful colleague from the Center for Human Sleep Science. That's my center here at UC Berkeley. She is an epic, epic scientist. She is a senior scientist at the center. I'm talking about Dr. Etty Ben-Simone. Etty, welcome.
Hi, everyone. Very happy to be here.
I am so glad I get to have the world exposed to your brilliance. I should note that, gosh, Etty and I have been working together for many, many years now, and she's done incredible, incredible work. So yes, she's a brilliant scientist. She's got all the credentials, and you'll see, you know, just how insightful and smart she is in this episode. But also, I would just like to note that she, above and beyond that, is one of the most remarkably kind, composed, incredible human beings that you will ever meet. And I say that because every time that I spend time with Etty, I walk away wanting to be a better person as a consequence. That's how incredible she is. So do not say anything, Etty. Do not try to reject any of the platitudes because I know you are too humble.
You're too kind. You're
not
too kind.
At all. So welcome to the show. So let's get to it. We've got a large collection of questions to get through, and I will just let you navigate the questions, ask me the questions, tell me I was wrong in saying what I did, and correct me. Off
All right.
You go. For those who are struggling with sleep, one recommendation I've offered in the past is meditation. Now, I was a complete skeptic at first. I thought it was all just, you know, a little bit out there. But the data for restoring sleep was so strong. So I tried it. And that was 7 years ago. And I've been meditating for 10 minutes before bed every night since. The app I've been using is called Calm. And I decided to partner with them here. And Calm have agreed to offer a full 40% off its premium subscription to you, the listeners of this good podcast. So to get that 40% off, just go to calm.com/Matt Walker. And that is calm, calm.com/Matt Walker. And you will get 40% off your subscription. So again, that's calm.com/Matt Walker.
Let's dive right in. So the first question is about the major differences in sleep between men and women. Is it true that women require more sleep? And if so, why is that?
Ooh, great questions. So there are definitely some fascinating differences in sleep between males and females. Sleep, as everyone knows from this podcast, it's a fundamental physiological process. And your sleep is going to be shaped by various factors including age. And we're probably going to get to that in a different later question. lifestyle factors. So see the episodes on alcohol and caffeine on this podcast. Environmental factors, things like temperature, which we've also done a podcast on, and your genetics, for example, too. But an often overlooked influence is the biological factor of sex and the sex of an individual. And here, as is done in biology, I'll refer to that as male or female. So let me address whether or not females require more sleep than males. And I'll try to break it down into sort of big picture structures of sleep, such as sleep duration, sleep quality, and then we'll go into detail into the architecture of sleep. So sleep duration, there have been lots of studies now showing that reliably, on average, females will sleep slightly longer than males. So if you look across all of the data and you sort of collect it all together, and I think I last did a deep dive into this decade of work, probably about 8 or 9 months ago. So there may be a few papers that have come out recently. But when we bring at least middle-aged males and females, just to try to be representative, into the lab, and we allow them to express their full, true, innate sleep need, what we found is that females will usually get a mean total amount of sleep of right around about 7.8 hours each night, whereas males will get around about 7.7 hours. So it's modest. It's a range between 20 to 40 minutes if you look at the data, which is not trivial, but it's reliable and it's statistically significant. So that's duration. Females do sleep longer than males. Next, we can speak about sleep quality. And here, it's also interesting. We found that females will typically have fewer wake episodes than males. They will be awake or have fewer awakenings throughout the night on average. They will have an average of about 1.5 wake instances per night compared to males, who will have an average of about 1.7 awake instances per night. Matthew, just give me some hard stats. It probably translates to females experiencing about a 13% lower frequency of the number of awakenings throughout the night relative to males. But there's a caveat that I'll come on to when it comes to quality, and I'll come back to that in just a little while. So that's quantity and quality. Now let me dig into sleep architecture. And as you'll remember from this show, sleep architecture describes the structure and the pattern of your sleep, and that encompasses the various stages, such as REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, and also deep non-rapid eye movement sleep or non-REM sleep. And what we found, and I think there was probably the most recent paper I read, it was a great paper that came out in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine, and they found that females tend to have a higher percentage of deep non-REM sleep than males, and that's age matched across the lifespan. Although once we get into older age, things change a little bit more too, and we'll come to that in a question on aging. It's not by much, though, in early adult life and middle adult life in terms of the deep sleep difference. Don't think it's catastrophically like whopping. It's around about, if you look at the studies, it's about 7.8% greater amount. So in other words, about 8% greater deep sleep. But what's interesting is that that greater amount of deep sleep in females isn't homogeneous across the night. And what I mean by this, using stupid long words, man. What I mean by that is you see that difference only in the first third of the night compared to males. But once you get to the second and the third components of sleep, the third of the night of sleep, allow myself to introduce myself. Oh, Matthew, you get about the same deep sleep. So it's still modest, but it's reliable and it's statistically significant. Yes, there are differences in deep sleep, but let's not forget REM sleep. And REM sleep, as you'll remember, is associated with dreaming. It's associated with emotional regulation and also memory and creativity. Now, REM sleep also differs between females and males. I'm not going to make any stereotypes as to better emotional regulation and better creativity here in one sex compared to another. But if REM sleep is an indication of that, here's what we found: that females will have a more rapid onset of REM sleep relative to males. And so, in other words, females will quickly call up on the menu of different sleep stages across the night. They will call up REM sleep earlier in the night. Now, again, it's not huge. It's by about 10 minutes. Why is this? Why do they dive into and start consuming REM sleep earlier in the sleep cycle? We have lots of theories, but for time, I may not necessarily go into it, but it may be related to more of that aspect of emotional wellness and mental health wellness. Etty, I don't know, you are far more brilliant and genius in this area of sleep and mental health. Any thoughts also on when REM sleep arrives earlier in females, theories as to why that would be? And again, I don't think anyone has a hard definitive answer, but what would your thoughts be on that?
Yeah, we don't really know specifically why, but there is indication that getting into REM sleep earlier is not necessarily a benefit. We see that people who suffer from depression or different sleep disorders tend to get REM sleep earlier. So it remains to be seen if that's something to be concerned about.
I think it's very interesting. We have seen that in literature where people with major depression, that's not bipolar disorder, but with major depression, they do have REM sleep arriving earlier. So it may be an adaptive function, a benefit where females are trying to begin working on those emotional, affective, mental health components earlier. Or it may be some aspect of that, which is that on average, we do see a slight trend towards females suffering greater rates and likelihood of depression and also anxiety too, which is an area that
almost a doubling.
That's right. That's right. You are the world's expert on that. So the final thing I should probably note is about hormonal influences in females, of course, both across menstruation and also during menopause. I think I'm going to leave that because I hope that there's a question maybe later on that I can speak to that. The only other thing now you've reminded me, Etty, is to mention sleep disorders rather than psychiatric mood disorders. We also know, by the way, in terms of differences between males and females, females are almost twice as likely, if not more, to suffer from insomnia relative to males. However, males are almost twice as likely, if not more, to have sleep apnea or sleep disordered breathing. But keep this in mind. That does not mean, however, just because females are more likely to suffer from insomnia, it doesn't mean that many males do not have insomnia. They do. And equally, it doesn't mean that many, many women have sleep apnea, often undiagnosed and often untreated. So I think the sort of the conclusion here is that sleep needs do vary quite considerably and in quite a nuanced way based on biological sex, both in terms of sleep duration, so quantity, quality, sleep architecture, and the severity of sleep disorders and sleep disruption.
Do you want to touch a bit on why do we think these physiological changes in terms of increased slow wave amounts, for instance, in female versus male. Do we have any thoughts on why is that happening?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question. Why do you also have a greater demand for deep sleep early on in the night, which is what we just described? Some of that may be because the buildup of sleepiness across the day is greater in females relative to males. And when you have greater sleepiness buildup across the day, you typically have a greater response in the amount of deep sleep, especially in the first third of the night. The other aspect, which you are familiar with, Etty, is that, as I mentioned, female individuals will have significantly higher rates of anxiety. And you have elegantly discovered, you've been the first really to discover it, that deep sleep seems to help almost offer this anxiolytic, this anxiety quieting benefit to decrease and dissipate the accumulated anxiety that's built up across the day. And perhaps this is why we're seeing what we would call as a homeostatic response. In other words, the system understands the needs and it responds dynamically. That's sort of the homeostatic notion to bring things back into balance the next morning in terms of net-net neutral anxiety. I'm going to come back to issues around menstruation and changes in non-REM. So I'll leave those out for a second, but please don't think I'm ignoring those. But yeah, anything else on that more general front?
That makes perfect sense. And we will touch upon changes in aging and hormonal changes and how that affects males and females later on. We have a question on that.
A sponsor of today's show is Inside Tracker, which is a service that comes out to your home and they will analyze your blood and your DNA to know precisely what is going on inside of you. Hence the name, Inside Tracker. They look at your blood, your metabolic signals, your hormonal health metrics, and then they give you a personalized, actionable set of lifestyle changes in response to that readout. And the goal there is to improve your health. I was looking and informed they have some new cardiovascular and new hormonal biomarkers that I'm particularly interested in. One that I'm focused on is something called ApoB, which is an absolutely critical heart health measure. And I get it done now with them somewhere between 4 to 6 times a year. Why? Well, my family, unfortunately, has a strong history of cardiovascular disease, so I am checking that pretty ruthlessly. And by the way, I do buy the product myself out of pocket. I don't want to fall prey to any of those trappings and undue incentives. Although, with full admission, I still use my own discount code that you can use to get some money off. And that code for you is insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. So just go over to insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. And again, if you want to get that discount, it is insidetracker.com/Matt Walker. Thanks very much. Oh my goodness. Tell me, was that the first question?
That was just the first question.
Let's get into this. Come on, Walker. Be a bit quicker. Okay.
Next one is about sleep trackers. So do you think sleep trackers like Oura, Fitbit, or Apple Watches benefit or hinder sleep? Do you find these devices accurate and useful? And would you recommend any of them?
Such good questions. And it is a question that I get asked when I do a lot of public speaking and public appearances at different events. And I get asked this question so much. So I understand that the need. Sleep trackers like Oura, Apple Watch, and numerous others, they have become increasingly popular as tools to gauge your sleep quantity and quality. Full disclaimer up front, I am actually an advisor to Oura. Oura, that's spelled O-U-R-A, and it's a ring that you put on your finger, and it looks like a normal ring, but it tracks all of your sleep and your exercise and all of that good stuff, as well as actually female menstruation cycles. So I'm going to try and shy away from being only Oura specific here. Why? Because this podcast for me is about maintaining independent integrity. That's part of the reason that you listen to this podcast, I hope. With that said, feel free to take everything I say about Oura with a grain of salt, but I'll explain why I chose them ultimately. But when people ask me what's the best sleep tracker, my answer is usually not the one that they expect or they really wanted, because my answer is this: the best sleep tracker is the one that you wear most frequently. And I'll come back to why I give that answer in just a minute. But let me start with the sticky topic of accuracy of sleep trackers. How do we determine their accuracy? Well, we compare them to what's called polysomnography, and you've heard about polysomnography before on this show. Essentially, it's a sleep laboratory study where you look like a spaghetti monster. We put electrodes all over your face and your head and all sorts of other areas.
Or rainbow hippie.
Yes, thank you, Eddie. Yes, very Berkeley specific there. True. Digital hippie is basically what we turn you into. And then occasionally delightful things such as rectal probes, but I won't go there. So That is the
goal. Thing, when we connect people to the electrodes and we get to send them to sleep at home, and they're worried about people kind of pointing at them and looking at them. But Berkeley is so weird that they go out with that spaghetti monster on their head and nobody bats an eye.
No, yeah, I know. They basically look like the most normal person on the street.
Exactly.
That is, yeah, wandering the very variegated streets of Berkeley, let's exactly. just call them. And exactly. I love it. So polysomnography is the gold standard for sleep recordings, and that's what we will compare all of these sleep trackers to gauge their accuracy. And when you compare the varied sleep trackers relative to polysomnography, or what we call PSG for short, on average, most of those devices have an accuracy of between about 70 to 80% in terms of separating you being awake versus you being asleep. And that algorithm of separation of awake from sleep is what we call a two-class algorithm. In other words, you're trying to separate between two classes, two brain states, wake and sleep. And at that, they're pretty good, 70 to 80%. For the data I know from Aura, it is a little bit higher. It's one of the reasons that I favor them. But again, take all of that with the knowledge of me being on the inside of Aura and being an advisor. But essentially, being on the inside, I kind of know how the sausage is made, as it were. So all sleep trackers are then less accurate at differentiating between light non-REM sleep and REM sleep. And there you drop down to accuracies of usually in the 60s, sort of across those, and it's different for some of them. And that's what we would call a four-class algorithm. So you're trying to separate wake from light non-REM sleep, from deep non-REM sleep, and REM sleep from four different states. And that's more difficult for an algorithm to do. And the way that those sleep trackers do that, by the way, is they usually use a variety of different signals, and they use movement, so they have an accelerometer in them. And then they use a pulse oximetry, so they will have sensors that will assess your heartbeat and your respiration, sometimes also your temperature and oxygen. More and more of them are doing that now as a way to try to see if you've got oxygen pauses, which could be an indirect measure, not FDA approved, of sleep apnea. So those are the different sensors that they use. And using those, you can get, it seems, pretty close to disambiguating not just wake from sleep, but the different stages of sleep. And I think when people hear, you know, accuracies of 65, I mean, I think for Aura, the last data I looked at, it was in the mid-70s for the four-class algorithm, which is, you know, really quite impressive in a way. And the reason I say it's impressive is because it's this ring that sits on your finger, and it gets 75, 80%, depending on the class of algorithm, to distinguishing what we have to do with tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, with all of these electro spaghetti monster things, respiration band all over you. And yet they can get so close within such a form factor. And it's really quite amazing. So that's the accuracy picture. Let me speak about the utility of sleep trackers, because that whoever mentioned that in the question, it's a very insightful question. The way I think about this, and the reason, again, coming back to why I chose Aura, is that when we go to sleep, we take things off. We don't put things on. Gosh, I'm such a sleep tech nerd. I have bought and worn every single device that you can imagine. I probably expect it's been terminal for some of my relationships coming in to the bedroom with all the gear on, people looking at you thinking, I've never wanted you more. But so I've tried them all, and that's what I noticed, and that's what I hear from other people. Wearing a wristwatch to bed, I'm not that comfortable with it. Like a chest strap, I haven't really enjoyed that either. But rings, lots of people go to bed with rings. And so that's why I've liked the form factor of a ring sleep tracker. And again, I'm just being agnostic. There are other rings out there. Aura is, I think, at the top of that chain. It's not quite Lord of the Rings, one ring to rule them all, but that's why I like the form factor of the ring. Are they useful then? We've spoken about accuracy, but that's not really answering the question of, are they useful? In general, I would say yes. I think if you approach sleep trackers in a healthy way and you don't have sleep issues like insomnia, I think they can be very helpful. Why? Why do I think that? Well, because of awareness and behavioral change. One of the most, I think, significant advantages of sleep trackers is the heightened awareness that they provide. And in medicine, we often say what gets measured gets managed. And sleep, by the way, is different to exercise and food. For example, if I were to ask you, Etty, how well have you been eating this past week? You would be able to tell me, I suspect, you know, have you been able to be active or get to the gym every day this week? My guess is that you could tell me the answers to that. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
And you don't have to give the answers. That's lovely. But let's say that if you didn't have a sleep tracker, and then I were to follow up with a final question where I said, how much deep sleep did you get last Tuesday? And you have absolutely no idea.
No idea. Not even last night.
Exactly.
It's really hard to assess.
You have no conscious perception of that, but you do have a waking conscious memory imprint of how well you've been eating and how you've been exercising. So sleep is uniquely different, I think, in that way. And by offering some tangible data on sleep problems, individuals may then be more inclined to adopt healthier sleep habits. And there was a fascinating study. It was done by, I think, Barron and colleagues. And what they found was that about 67% of users of sleep trackers changed their sleep behaviors based on the feedback from those wearable devices. So I think that that's one point in favor of the utility and how they can change. And I've heard from so many people when they say, I just now know that if I have a couple of glasses with wine in the evening, or we open a bottle of wine with friends, my deep sleep and my REM sleep is absolutely decimated on my Oura Ring. So I think it's really valuable in that sense. And by the way, PS, I'm not puritanical, even though I have been in the past about alcohol. Life is to be lived. Goodness me, just enjoy a drink now and again, if you wish. Even though, by the way, the World Health Organization has said that there is no safe amount of alcohol, and I don't drink myself, but I'm getting tied up in terms of trying to be politically correct.
I'm with you on that, actually.
Thank you. N of one support. Simpatico. So that utility, but let me finally finish with limitations and pitfalls, because there are some. It is crucial to recognize the downsides. One, you can become over-reliant on these devices, and that can result in what I think of as performance pressure, or sort of performance anxiety, where individuals become obsessed with achieving perfect sleep scores, and that can potentially lead to increasing sleep-related anxiety. That's not for everyone, and I'll come on to a specific condition for which it is. If you are experiencing that, if it's getting not enjoyable and you are getting anxious, I would say take off the watch, take off the ring, put it in a drawer or keep it charged, and just give yourself a week or 2 weeks of a detox, get your sea legs back underneath you, and you can go back to sleep tracking. Or if you don't want to lose that data, keep wearing them, but only check your sleep data once a week on, let's say, a Friday evening. That's what I would recommend. So the question of anxiety does bring me on to an increasingly clinical question, which is that some people can become so anxious about their tracked sleep values that they suffer from what we call orthosomnia. And that's where people become overly concerned to try and achieve this perfect sleep, which paradoxically leads to even worse sleep. Now, it doesn't look like it's a large proportion of people, but in truth, I don't think there's good survey studies to understand what fraction of the population suffer from that. What is, by the way, orthosomnia? We love words on this show. Orthosomnia, it's rooted from the Greek word of ortho, which means straight nor correct. Now, by the way, you all understand this. You just don't know it. You've heard of orthopedics, straightening bones. You've heard of orthodontics, straightening teeth. Orthosomnia is, and somnia being somnolent sleep, is about trying to get your sleep correct or get your sleep straight, as it were. So that is one of the potential downsides of sleep trackers. Overall, I would say, I think, again, if you're healthy and you're not suffering from insomnia, I think they can be very valuable tools, but just use them wisely. Don't let them control you or your mental health. Anything that you would love to add to that?
I just want to echo that technology is neither good or bad. It's there for a benefit. So if you feel like it's not benefiting you, just go to sleep tech-free. That's perfectly fine. I also want to add onto something I really like that you said, that the sleep tracker of choice is the one that you use most consistently. Every algorithm has its downfalls, but once you use it every night, the effects of the impairments in the algorithm are getting washed out. And when you're consistent in tracking your sleep using the same device, you get a sense of how your sleep is being judged by the device. And I absolutely agree that the greatest benefit of sleep trackers is people being more aware of what their sleep is like, what makes them sleep better.
Oh my goodness. This is why Etty is on the show, and you're going to just think she's such an essential part of the podcast now. I miss this. This is a crucial thing about accuracy. You are so right. And it's the difference between what we call absolute accuracy compared to relative accuracy. So I described to you numbers in the 80s and the high 70s of the accuracy. I'm talking about the absolute accuracy. So on any one night relative to polysomnography, that is how absolutely accurate they are. But what's lovely, as you just said, Etty, is that once you start tracking your sleep over time, then we're not really worried about necessarily the absolute numbers every single night. What we're interested in is the relative changes. So now if you look back, let's say across your past month, and you see a gradual decline in your deep sleep, and you've been feeling very stressed and anxious, that decline, you should believe it with much more confidence than the absolute accuracy. Because every single night, even though the device is absolutely inaccurate to a degree, it is consistently inaccurate every single night. Its algorithm does not change. The hardware does not change. The one thing that's different in that equation is you. And so therefore, my recommendation is, when it comes to sleep trackers, try not to follow nightly headlines. Follow monthly trend lines. The trend lines, the relative accuracy of these devices is very, very high. I mean, in other words, the change over time, the absolute accuracy on any one single night is consistent with the 70, 80% values that I was describing. Thank you for saying that. Okay, let's get to next question.
All right, the next question is kind of a big topic. What are the changes in sleep across the lifespan, going from babies to adolescents to adults?
Ooh, great question too. Wow, there are so many demonstrable physiological changes that happen with age, but I would put sleep right up there in probably the top five. It is very dramatic indeed. There are significant transformations across all spans, and I'll go into detail. And as you go into older age, and I think we'll come on to older age in a second, and I'm becoming painfully aware of those those changes, alas.
But same here.
Oh, it's in the mail. It's coming at all of us. So let me see if I can split it down based on age groups, and I will try to speak about sleep durations and sleep architecture, and I'll try to step and repeat that format for each one of the age groups. Let me start with babies. And here I'm talking about newborns up to maybe 3 months old. Sleep duration, how much sleep? Newborns are going to be clocking anywhere between 14 to 17 hours of sleep across the 24-hour period. Here's the problem, though. It is not continuous sleep. That sleep, that 14 to 17 hours across the 24-hour span, occurs in short bursts throughout the day and throughout the night, as new parents will also painfully tell you about. It is called highly polyphasic sleep, and it is not fun if you are being woken to a polyphasic sleep schedule. Oh, all parents, you are absolute gems to go through it. So that's duration for newborns. Their architecture is interesting. Sleep in those early stages from newborns to 3 months, we don't really classify them according to all of those different four stages of non-REM, you know, stages one and two, which is light, stages three and four, which is deep, and then REM sleep. We really split it into two. We bifurcate it into what we call active sleep in newborns, which is akin to adult REM sleep, and then quiet sleep, which we think is akin to non-rapid eye movement sleep. And what we found is that, unbelievably, REM sleep will constitute about 50% of the entire sleep amount of the entire 14 to 17 hours that newborns will sleep. And I should do a podcast on this too. There are many brain development theories as to why. There is, I think, no species that has REM sleep that does not express the greatest amounts of REM sleep across the lifespan than in the newborn to 3 month phase, if those species are lasting that long and have REM sleep. Why is this? Well, in mammals, and particularly in humans, one of the theories is that REM sleep at this stage is not doing all the things that REM sleep does that I've described previously on the podcast. One of its principal roles is it's almost acting as, you've got all of these new neighborhoods in the brain in a newborn. And what REM sleep is doing is acting as an internet service provider and is racing through all of these neighborhoods, all of the different districts and territories. And it is laying down all of this high-speed fiber optic connectivity in the brain. And it's sprouting all of that connectivity. That's one of the key theories as to why we think infants and newborns have so much REM sleep, have such an appetite for REM sleep. Then let me come on to infants. And here we're talking about 4 months to maybe 12 months. Let me come to duration. Remember, newborns, somewhere between 14 to 17 hours. For infants, 4 months to 12 months, they're going to drop down to an average of about 12 to 15 hours per day. And crucially for new parents listening, by around the age of 6 months, on average, about 60% of infants will have nightly sleep durations that exceed 6 hours in length. In other words, by the 6 month mark, you can expect sleep to become more consolidated, less awakenings, and a good number of infants at that stage may be having a good solid up to 6 hour chunk of sleep at night, which means that you get to have a 6 hour chunk of sleep at night. At this point, REM sleep now is starting to decline, which is very interesting. It's already done some of its fiber optic sprouting stimulation, mixing metaphors work, and it is dropping by about 10%. So, well, 20%, if you look at some of the studies, it's dropping down to about roughly 30 to 40% of the total sleep time, where it was 50% in newborns. Then by around this age of probably around 6 months or more, you start to see the emergence of true non-REM sleep, and including deeper non-REM sleep and the slow waves of non-REM sleep. They start to play a more prominent role in your total amount of sleep. And again, we think that now non-REM sleep takes over some different brain maturation functions at that stage, and also some physiological body functions, including some aspects of hormonal changes. Let me move on to children. And here I'll draw a big bucket, but I'll separate it down. I'll go from maybe children defined as 1 year all the way up to 12 years, but don't worry, I'll split it. Let me start with sleep duration. Sleep duration continues its gradient decline. Toddlers, as I would call them, sort of 1 to 2 years, they typically require about 11 to 14 hours. Preschoolers, 3 to 5 years, typically somewhere between 10 to 13 hours with wiggle room around the side. And then coming on to school age kids, 6 to 12, there you're usually seeing sleep amounts of somewhere between 9 to 10 to 12 to 13 hours. That's duration. But now let me go lower, as we've been doing this sort of format, going into architecture. At that point, the amount of slow wave sleep really does start to peak during this phase of childhood. And so, for example, if you look at, say, 5-year-olds, the amount of slow wave sleep that they're having across their total sleep period can be as much as 30 to 35%. Now, that's a lot relative to us adults, where, and we'll get to this, those numbers can be fantastically depressing, and they can be in the realm of about 12 to 22%. So they're having whopping relative amounts of deep sleep. And their REM sleep continues to decrease. And by this stage, kids at around, maybe around age 10, they're down to about 20% of REM sleep, which is not too far off typical adult levels. Adolescents, 13 to 18, I suppose. And ideally, adolescents need to be getting somewhere between 9 to 11 hours of sleep a night. Estimates do differ, but due to a myriad of factors, if you look at the data in terms of what's going on with all of the academic pressures, biological shifts in their circadian rhythm, early school start times, which we may get to, many teenagers are going to be averaging, if you look at the data, somewhere between 6.5, maybe 7 hours of sleep relative to the 9, 10, 11 hour sleep need. So think of that as a percentage difference, and then think about your sleep need. And if I were to do that every single night of the week, I were to shave off 10, 15, 20% of your sleep, you're not going to be in the best of moods. Probably not going to lead to the best sense of style and fashion, judging people by my own adolescent standards. So that's duration. Now let me come on to architecture. Here we see that deep sleep will now start to decline. Where it was peaking during childhood, it does start to decline somewhat in terms of total amount. But there's nuance here, because during adolescence, there can be these almost incredible swelling storms of deep sleep over different parts of the cortex. So whilst deep sleep in total can gradually decline relative to childhood, there does seem to be a deep, slow brainwave electrical oscillation increase in certain parts of the cortex, and then it declines. And it seems to track very well with the final touches to brain maturation. If you look at the structure of the brain, and oh gosh, I'm blanking on his name, and he's a wonderful researcher at UC Davis, Feinberg. Thank you, Matthew's brain. He's done epic work on this. And then, by the way, REM sleep is now still stable, somewhere between sort of that 20, maybe up to 25%. Finally, adults, I think people probably know this data by now because I've done lots of basic podcasts on this. Adults, we need somewhere on average between 7 to 9 hours, again, for the average adult. But as I've also spoken about, that's influenced by genetics. In terms of architecture, what should you be looking at? Well, ranging from early to middle adulthood, you can expect to be getting somewhere between about 22% down to about 12% in terms of your deep sleep numbers. REM sleep still usually shows, and this is based on polysomnography, I'm not talking about sleep trackers, that's different. REM sleep will usually continue its trend of stability, and it will still be hovering around about the 20%-ish mark with wiggle room. I think that's a whirlwind tour of the lifespan.
Yeah.
So, in about 8 minutes, based on duration and architecture. What have I missed? What have I glossed over?
8 minutes around the world. So we can summarize that overall REM sleep tends to decrease, and then deep sleep has kind of an emergence in early life, and then it goes to a certain peak, and then also a decline. And so does that mean that the stages of light sleep tend to increase with age?
Thank you for saying that. I could have answered this question in 60 seconds. I could have said that total sleep duration across the lifespan decreases. REM sleep across the lifespan starts very high and decreases. Deep non-REM sleep starts off in modest amounts, then rises as a peak into childhood and some aspects of adolescence, and then drops back down again. And will decline further into older age, and we'll speak about that. So that's the TLDR that I should have put at the front. The relative amounts of light and non-REM sleep, let's say in childhood relative to adulthood, are somewhat higher. percentage-wise, there is greater amounts of light non-REM sleep in adults relative to children. Why this is, we don't know. If it serves a functional purpose, we don't know. I think I just released a podcast on motor skill learning a couple of weeks back, and there we were speaking about the importance of stage two. We sometimes think of light non-REM sleep, which unfortunately globs together light stage one non-REM and stage two non-REM. But I was talking about stage two non-REM, which we think has many functions. So we shouldn't think about all of light non-REM sleep as being bad sleep or poor sleep. In fact, as an adult, it's the dominant stage of sleep. We will spend about 50% of our time in stage two non-REM sleep across the night, sometimes a little bit less. And we don't truly understand. I think it's not the case that because you have to go through stage two to get into deep sleep, and you have to go back through stage two to get up to REM sleep during the sleep cycle, I don't think it's simply a transitional stage. I think you could make that transition much more quickly if it wasn't functional. So I think there are functions of stage two non-REM sleep. It's a very good question, and I don't think sleep science has got the very best set of answers yet. Does that make some sense, Etty?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense, and I totally agree.
There's someone who is like giving me the thumbs up.
The whole street, Matt. The whole street with you.
Is listening. Oh my goodness. This podcast is supported by Athletic Greens, which is now known as AG1. AG1 is a comprehensive nutritional drink that contains countless key health components. Actually, let me stop there. I say countless, but I actually know the company. I know how the product is made. And I believe at last count, it's over 75 different vitamins, minerals, probiotics, prebiotics, and other whole food nutrient sources. I do drink AG1 every day for the record. And also for the record, I buy my own supply because of all of the obvious integrity trappings that come with the free product. I know the company well, I know how the product is made, and I genuinely trust in their manufacturing. They are registered and approved by the Therapeutic Goods Administration. They also have GMP stamps, which means good manufacturing practice badges. Basically, they're rigorous. So if you'd like to pick up an offer and get some money off your first order, and also get some free travel packs, just go to the link drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. So that's drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. And you will get some money off your purchase. So again, last time, that is drinkag1.com/Matt Walker. In truth, I do also use my own link to try and get some money off. I do buy it myself, but I do use the link to get that code money off too. And you can use that link as well. Thanks very much. Okay, let's move on because I think we've got a related question.
Yes, people wanted to zoom in on adults. So this is basically a question on aging. So if we look at, let's start now from young adults all the way to older adults, do we see the same trends continue in sleep in terms of structure and quality?
Overall, to a degree, yes. And I suppose we're going to come on to maybe aging and Alzheimer's disease here too, if you'll give me that leeway. But for older adults, and usually the way we classify that is 65 years and older, sleep duration, and again, I'll go into sleep duration, sleep architecture, now it's declining, and it's declining quite significantly. Sleep duration can typically drop down to anywhere between about 5.5 hours a night, if you look at the data, and sometimes in best case, 7 hours each night. And we've been able to attribute that to several different factors, things such as altered circadian rhythms, decreased melatonin production, which is all about the timing of sleep, and also a lot of the machinery inside of the brain that generates sleep itself starting to atrophy, which is a fancy way of saying starting to deteriorate. Just like the rest of our bodies deteriorate, our brains deteriorate with age. the decline in sleep, and I'll come on to deep sleep, is perhaps one of the most significant physiological changes that we see in aging. Oh, which brings me on to a myth, by the way. There is a myth I'd like to address. That myth is that older adults sleep less because older adults need less sleep. And that's not true. We know that older adults have weaker bones. And that's simply, and then we would say, well, that's simply because as we become older, we don't need bones that are as strong. No, we don't say that. That's ridiculous. We actually often supplement older adults with things like calcium, etc., to try to improve the strength of their bones. And we'll ask them to engage in resistance training and resistance exercise. In other words, lifting weights, which can improve and build up that strength of the bones. So older adults, we believe, will still need just as much sleep as midlife adults. It's simply that they don't have the brain apparatus to generate the sleep that they still necessarily need. So that sleep duration declines. Let me speak about sleep architecture, because that is very pronounced in terms of differences. The biggest difference that we see, hands down, in aging is a decline in deep non-REM sleep or slow wave sleep. Now, you'll remember I was speaking about percentages in the mid to high teens, low 20s for adults. If you're a young adult, probably in the 20s we could expect. For older adults, they can drop down to values as low as 5%. And Etty, you've done some incredible work in this area of sleep and aging too. And, you know, I remember us looking at data, and sometimes it's actually very hard to even detect any of these deep sleep brainwaves. We've actually, and correct me if I'm wrong, Etty, but we've actually had to try to change our computer algorithms that quantify and measure how many of these deep sleep brainwaves that you're having. We've had to try and open up the gates and be even more liberal with what we call a deep sleep to even see if there are anything like these deep sleep brainwaves, because most of those big, powerful, deep, slow brainwaves are so non-existent in older adults that our algorithms, because we have to use standardized thresholds for what we call a big, powerful, slow wave sleep, or not a slow wave, those margins that are set are unachievable by older adults. And therefore, technically, they do not have very much, if any, slow waves. You've seen that firsthand, if you're not.
Yeah, I've also coined the term slow wave envy, because every time a young student.
I've got slow wave, my heart just dropped because I've been seeing my Aura Ring numbers. That's exactly what I've got tonight.
Yeah, when young students come to the lab and you just look at the screen and they have these beautiful bursting slow waves, and you don't really have to be an older adult to see it. Even in our age, even in midlife, the change in slow wave amount and the power of the slow waves is just really noticeable.
It is, Joanne. I definitely have seen that before, particularly in some of the young, healthy kids who just, some of them, sometimes they come in, they've probably been sleeping in dorms, haven't been sleeping that well. They've built up a decent sleep pressure. They come in, they have, because we have an adaption night where we'll let them get used to the lab, but usually what we found in some of the studies I was doing back at Harvard was they would sleep almost better on the first night that we would record them, because they were so sleep deprived from sleeping in dorms, which were so noisy, when we were expected the first night to be a bad night because they're getting used to the sleep laboratory. They just thought, clean sheets, it's quiet, I am gone for the night and I am not coming back. And you would look at these powerful brainwaves. Oh, that's what I would have. I would have slow wave envy. Oh, that's going to be the title of my next album. Okay. By the way, REM sleep now is interesting in aging. REM sleep remains relatively stable throughout adulthood. Now, that's not to say that there aren't declines in REM sleep. There are, and they can drop down to somewhere in the region of 15 to 20%, whereas when you're a young, healthy individual, they're solidly in the 20s there. I would say that, though, we've been doing some very recent work, which is not published yet, so I shouldn't probably be discussing it, but I will, which is that the electrical quality of your REM sleep is not the same in older adults. So yes, the REM sleep itself doesn't seem to decline that much in aging. However, we are now starting to see these really subtle but quite significant reliable changes in the electrical brainwave oscillations of REM sleep. And we're starting to find that those do have consequences for brain health and for cognitive performance. But I won't get into that. The last thing I'll mention is Alzheimer's disease. Now, I'm not going to go into too much detail because I've done an entire podcast on sleep and Alzheimer's disease. We have done a lot of work in this area. It's probably the area of sleep science that I've done the most work in across my career. Starting with Alzheimer's disease, what is it? It's a degenerative brain disorder, and it profoundly impacts both sleep and also cognitive and mental function, but also emotional health, by the way. That is a missing piece. And Etty has been one of the pioneers of doing a lot of work in Alzheimer's disease related pathology and emotional health problems and sleep. So let me start with sleep duration. At this point, even relative to age-matched older adults who are having maybe just 5.5, 6 hours of sleep, Alzheimer's disease patients are usually down at least 10 to 15% in terms of their total amount of sleep. So they are typically batting below 5 hours a night. Then to architecture of sleep. Here, what we see is an even more dramatic hit on deep non-REM sleep. If there was any of that deep non-REM sleep that was observable in aged matched older adults, it is very difficult to find it in patients with Alzheimer's disease. In fact, even relative to the minimal amounts that healthy older adults have, they can be suffering 30% less deep non-REM sleep. REM sleep is also decreased. So unlike the greater stability of REM in older age relative to midlife, REM sleep also does take a quite significant hit in Alzheimer's disease. There's also usually a delay in the first appearance of REM sleep. So their REM sleep takes longer to arrive and is less abundant in amount. So both REM and non-REM take a hit. The final thing I would say, which is one of the most problematic issues, because gosh, I would often go out to see my patients in nursing homes and speak with caregivers and family members. Alzheimer's disease patients, and we've now quantified this very well, will have much more frequent awakenings throughout the night. And that sleep fragmentation can be so severe that their sleep efficiency will drop down to maybe in the 60s. Now, if you're a young, healthy individual, your sleep efficiency should be, and sleep efficiency, by the way, is the amount of time that you're asleep relative to the amount of time in bed. So if I have 100% sleep efficiency, I'm sleeping the entire time I'm in bed. No one should expect that. It's actually unhealthy if we see that. What we'd be looking at is somewhere between 85 to 95% if you're a really good, healthy, young sleeper. Alzheimer's patients, they're not at 80%, they're not at 70%, they can be down to 60%. So they're spending 40% of the night awake. And of course, that leads to confusion episodes that can lead to them waking up, that can lead them to having accidents in the home or even leaving the home. It's a real problem. The final thing I should note, and it's something I mentioned in the Alzheimer's episode, we've been doing a lot of work where the two protein culprits that underlie Alzheimer's disease, which are called beta amyloid and tau protein, they seem to be, they're not the only bad actors in the sleep equation of Alzheimer's disease, but they seem to be very potent factors that are contributing to the sleep disturbances that I've just described. And the sleep-related disruption caused by beta amyloid and caused by tau protein seem to have different but equally impactful consequences to the cognitive performance of Alzheimer's patients and also the emotional and mental health functioning of those patients. I won't go into brain cleansing and the glymphatic system in Alzheimer's disease and sleep. I don't think that's really about changes or what happens in later life. And you can go to the Alzheimer's podcast on that. But I think I will stop there. What have I missed out there, Etty?
Well, that was a depressive journey through what's
we're all. You are expecting. So welcome. Yeah. Yeah. Matt Walker, hashtag depressogenic, who has deep sleep envy.
I just wanted to add, so sometimes, you know, as many things, when you compare the younger ages to the older ages, you see that the body is just working at an optimum at these young ages, and you see it in sleep as well. But what we have working for us at older age is the knowledge. And thank you, Matt, for helping everyone know more about sleep, because once we have the knowledge, we can take back some of the sleep that we deserve. I believe that.
Yeah, and I think in some ways, what you're delightfully talking about is knowing that sleep problems become increasingly prevalent as we get older. I think what you're really saying is, because we understand the importance of sleep and more about how sleep works, we can start to take measures to try to protect our sleep and give sleep and your sleeping brain the very best chance of achieving what it can do in those later phases of life. So I love that.
Exactly. Exactly. It always reminds me of the scene from Alice in Wonderland, where the queen tells her that she has to run in order to stay in place. And I feel like aging is kind of a similar process. We have to start running in order to keep what we already had.
Such an elegant metaphor, isn't it? Oh, Etty, thank you for guiding and navigating this. For people wanting to hear more of the wonderful voice and intellectual acumen of Dr. E.T. Ben-Simone, E.T., where can people find you if they want to look you up?
Oh, thank you, Matt. I have a website, sleepingeti, E-T-I.com. Please come read about the work. Send me a line.
So sleepingeti.com. Yes. Sleepingeti.com.
Yes, okay. I would love to hear from you. There's my Twitter there, my email. Send me your question.
Wonderful. And what is your Twitter handle?
My Twitter is my nickname in Hebrew, Etoush, E-T-O-O-S-H.
It's so good. What a... My nickname is something that you wipe your feet on, Matt. Etoush. It's very fitting, your elegance and your erudite nature. Mine is very fitting too.
Actually, your name wonderful. Kind of brings memories of a yoga mat, so I really like it. It's a relaxing experience.
Okay, good. Comforting, but hopefully not too filled with perspiration. Okay, and on that note, on that bombshell, we will leave it there, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you for sticking through this podcast. If it's really enjoyable and you've really liked it, then we may consider doing this once a month. I would love to have Etty on the show, as I'm sure many of you would do. For everyone listening out there, thank you so much. Take care. Good night. We wish you good sleep. All the best.
Bye.